This is KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio, here on NPR One.
The little village of Rugby, Tennessee, was founded in a remote corner of the Upper Cumberland region in Tennessee as a utopian community back in 1880 by noted English author Thomas Hughes. Within a short period of time, more than 400 settlers built Gothic-style homes, but by the beginning of the 20th century, the town languished and struggled to survive for decades. The spark of revival dates from the historic district earning a place on the National Register of Historic Places in 1972. A subsequent subdivision of newer homes and the town's pride in maintaining its original structures, including the library and church, continues to attract day trippers and those seeking a rural rustic B&B experience just an hour and a half drive away from Knoxville. I'm correspondent Tom Wilmer. Come along and join me for a visit with Historic Rugby volunteer Wayne Bowman, where we learn the rest of the story. Next up is a visit with Tennessee State Parks ranger and historian and reenactor Will Kenton at the 1,200-acre Fort Loudoun Historic State Park, situated on the outskirts of Vonore, Tennessee. The park is just a one-hour drive from Knoxville, but it's also a trip back in time to the era of British rule on the American frontier 260 years ago, in the midst of hostilities during the French and Indian War. Ranger Kenton also gives us a tutorial in operating a flintlock musket and bayonet. Here we are in a very remote, unique, distinctive village in Tennessee called Rugby. Tell us about the history and how you got here.
I'm Wayne Bowman. I'm a volunteer here. I tell everyone I'm the indentured volunteer because my wife's executive director. Rugby has been here since 1880. It was created as a village to attract young Englishmen who were the second sons of well-to-do families, but who wouldn't inherit anything. First sons inherited everything, second sons not so much. So an author named Thomas Hughes, who was also a member of Parliament and social reformer, invested in this village with the idea that second sons could come over, acquire land, work as farmers or merchants, and get a fresh start.
I think one of the fascinating attributes of this community and its development is that it was a very divergent social experiment.
It was. We were actually a socialist village and a classless village when we were created, which meant that pretty much anyone could live here. So we had Englishmen, we had people from Pennsylvania and Indiana and who worked here to help build the village. We had African Americans, and they all were treated equally. The idea was that everyone shared, and as a Christian socialist village, everyone contributed to its success.
It's really interesting because this wasn't the only social experiment in America or England at that time that was similar.
Yeah, there were a number of them around the country. Several modeled after Rugby for second sons, others by different ethnic groups or people who had different ideas, but the idea of pursuing a utopia was very popular at that time.
Yeah, very fascinating. So it had spurts and starts and setbacks and whatnot, and never really exploded as a community.
At its heyday, Rugby had about 450 people here. That's when we had a big inn on one end of town, and Rugby in its early days wasn't as remote as it is today because everyone traveled by rail. And if you're going from Chattanooga to Cincinnati, Rugby was a natural stop. When the inn burned, the village lost a lot of its income source. So it's waxed and waned over the years. Today, our population is 79.
Looking forward, you have lots that are for sale that have been purchased. So There is that prospect in the near to distant future of a new generation coming in and creating an infusion of energy here.
In the 1990s, a subdivision was created adjacent to the village called Beacon Hill. Homes were built there that were English Victorian design, but were modern in structure. So that brought in quite a few of our current residents. Some of those have sold their homes to new people, and we have a number of younger people who are coming in as the next generation. In addition to that, there are still a number of lots available in Rugby for people to build. Our hope is that we'll have more folks up here.
So this is a true literal historic attraction today. What is the auspices of the historic preservation?
Historic Rugby is managed by a company called Historic Rugby, Inc. It's a nonprofit that's been around for just over 50 years. We are sandwiched between the Big South Fork National River and Recreation Area, part of the National Park Service.
Okay, so that's the adjacent, yeah.
And then the Rugby State Natural Area, which is a Tennessee-owned property. So there's lots of hiking and outdoor activities.
So who typically is attracted enough to divert off the interstate and make the trek out here to Rugby?
Well, we have people who are curious about history, obviously. We have more and more adventure tourists who come for the hiking or kayaking or canoeing that's around the area. We have a number of events during the course of the year. Recently, we just finished British Fest, which was a celebration of English and Welsh and Irish and Scottish culture.
And what happens at the fest?
We have music, we have plays that are read, we have dancing, we have food, all sorts of things that are focused around British culture. We have Irish road bowling, which means you get to throw a cannonball down a public road.
That's great. And this truly is off the beaten path, a real getaway. And I understand there's a place to stay here, an inn of sorts.
Yes, we have historic lodging as part of Historic Rugby. There's also a bed and breakfast called Grey Gables. It's right down the road from the village. And a couple of other private lodging houses. So we have people coming to stay all the time, transferring themselves back to the 1880s. We even have a couple of haunted rooms for people who are really adventurous.
So one of the surprises of coming to the little rural outpost village of Rugby is that you guys are more wired in, high-speed internet than a lot of people in big cities.
We have faster internet here than I had in Knoxville when we moved here because they couldn't hire math teachers for the local school. There are a lot of rural schools here, and they couldn't afford math teachers for every school. So the local telephone company got a grant to put in fiber optic between the schools for distance learning. That allowed one teacher at the high school to teach all the schools, and he actually became the National Distance Learning Teacher of the Year. Telephone company had enough money left over after that to put fiber optic through their whole three-county service area. So we have remarkably fast internet way up here in the middle of nowhere.
So in everybody's home, you guys are high speed.
Yes.
I love it. So no wait for the dial-up.
Nope. Now, very ridiculous high speeds of internet.
That's so cool. And how did you guys come to be here?
Me personally?
Yeah, you and your wife.
My wife became executive director of Historic Rugby, and we moved from Knoxville up here. She has a background in anthropology and was interested in helping the village kind of build on its historical mission.
For further information, y'all have a website, I'm sure.
Our website is historicrugby.org, and we're also on Facebook and pretty active there. And my name is Wayne Bowman.
Wayne, thank you so much for sharing.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, and great weather today.
Yeah, it's beautiful here in Rugby.
And I'm Tom Wilmer reporting from the historic village of Rugby in Tennessee.
I'm Will Kenton, K-I-N-T-O-N.
Will, you're a park ranger here?
Yes, sir.
This is a very historic fort, isn't it?
It is. Fort Loudoun was a British fort during the French and Indian War. What most of the world knows is the Seven Years' War, but here in North America, where it got started, you'll more commonly hear it referred to as the French and Indian War.
Interesting. And whereabouts are we in Tennessee?
Well, we're in the town of Vonore, about 30 miles south of Knoxville, and in between Madisonville and Maryville.
And at the time, the frontier, this was the frontier.
Yes, sir. I would argue this was even beyond the frontier and deep into the wilderness, about a month's march from Charlestown, or what we now call Charleston, South Carolina.
And it's interesting, fascinating, that this was like going to the moon, and how they were able to communicate with their base station is amazing.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. And we know they had dispatches going back and forth, and the fort was never fully self-sufficient. They raised cattle, they raised crops, but they always counted on supplies being brought across the mountains. Mm-hmm. And traders would also bring word of news in different places.
And when they arrived here, this was Cherokee territory, correct?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. The Cherokee lived in other places, but in many respects, the Little Tennessee River Valley was the heart and soul of the Cherokee Nation.
They had some friendly periods and some adversarial periods here.
Yes, sir. The British and the Cherokee had been allied long before Fort Loudoun, and were on good terms through most of the fort's use. But when that alliance fell apart, it fell apart bad. In fact, when the Cherokee laid siege to Fort Loudoun, and Fort Loudoun was eventually surrendered to the Cherokee in August of 1760, that would be the first time a British fort ever fell to an army of American Indians.
It must have been really humiliating.
I suspect it was, and it was written about across the colonies and even across the ocean in Europe.
Going forward after that, it was resupplied and remanned later?
Well, no, sir. After the fort was surrendered, it was never used again in a military purpose.
Really? Interesting. And yet, the U.S. Army was right next door here, right?
Yes, sir. The Tellico Blockhouse was in use just across the river, and several years later, Fort Loudoun was in use 1756 through 1760. The Tellico Blockhouse officially was in use 1794 to 1807. There are some writings suggesting the troops at the blockhouse used some of the stones from the ruins of Fort Loudoun for foundation as well as making lime, though.
So today it's been rebuilt and recreated as best that archaeologists and historians understand the way it was configured, correct?
Yes, sir, that's true. We've used the archaeological data as well as some of the drawings from the time of Fort Loudoun. The musket I have, the King's Arm, would later be known by the name Brown Bess. It's a flintlock, and that just describes the way it fires. There are three parts of this weapon, three main parts, the lock, the stock, and the barrel. The lock is this part with the moving pieces, the stock is any of the wood, and this is the barrel. Well, here on the lock, there's a really hard rock called flint, and it's hard enough that should you sharpen the edge like we've done here, it will shave off small pieces of steel. Those small pieces are hot enough that they burn up as sparks due to the friction. At the same time, it throws that steel hammer forward so that your sparks can land down in your pan. And there would be black powder in the pan. It will not go off right now, but hopefully you will see a few sparks.
Can you describe don't go off half cocked?
Sure.
And a flash in the pan?
Sure. Going off half cocked. Right now, this position is at the half cocked position. I should pull the trigger and nothing happened. It should not go forward. But just as anything we make and we use has wear and tear and becomes less dependable, this could weaken and could go forward. If it goes forward from the half-cocked position, that means it's gone off when I didn't mean for it to. A pretty dangerous thing, even if it doesn't hit anybody, because it's certainly going to give away your position. A flash in the pan, when those sparks land in this pan, they land in black powder. That powder ignites. The fire runs through this small hole to the inside of the barrel, and once inside, it ignites this main charge of powder, and that's what builds up the force that pushes the musket ball out the barrel. Well, a flash in the pan is when the powder in the pan ignites, but the fire does not work its way to the inside, and the weapon does not go off. Essentially, it means a lot of smoke and no action. If you hear someone say, oh, he's an old flash in the pan, it's not a very kind thing to say at all. Now, a flash in the pan could become a hang fire where it works its way through slowly and goes off seconds later when you don't intend for it to. And to me, that's the most concerning, for me personally anyway, as a misfire. But this is the system that the soldiers had, the technology that they had in the age of Fort Loudoun. It replaced an earlier musket that had a burning rope called slow match that would dip down into the pan. Now, this weapon will just fire one time and then it's empty. When you're close to the enemy, that's a problem because they could stop you from reloading. Years before Fort Loudoun, the solution was to put a second soldier next to the one with the musket. And that second soldier carried a big long spear called a pike. He protected you. Of course, I do have the hanger, the short sword, but you can see it does not reach out very far. If I pull this out on the battlefield, a number of things have gone wrong for me. But the French came up with the world's first bayonet, this plug bayonet. Plug part of the name comes from the way this tapered wooden handle plugs into the barrel. Bayonet from Bayonne, France, where they first made them. Changed warfare forever. Now every soldier can carry a musket. There's no need for the pikeman. But when the enemy's close, fix your plug bayonet and you are your own pikeman. The obvious drawback with that is my barrel is plugged up, so I cannot load or fire the weapon. And the socket bayonet that I have here solves that problem. That hole, that socket, fits over the outside of the barrel. And this piece that I'm tapping, most of us, myself included, would see it and think it a sight. But it's actually a lug. Its job is to lock in on this bayonet. And we still use bayonets today, all these years later. We still use bayonet lugs. Both of them look a bit differently, but it's the same basic weapon that was in use years before we began our fight to become a free and independent nation. And we know at least on one occasion the soldiers here at Fort Loudoun did carry surplus powder in a powder horn, a horn made out of cow horn. But that was not what the soldiers wanted to have, because it takes you longer to load and fire your weapon that way. This bag, this cartridge box, would hold pre-rolled cartridges. It would have the lead musket ball in the bottom, the black powder on top. It's all rolled up in paper. And I would rip this open, pouring a small amount of powder here in the pan. And that's the powder that should ignite first. I shut my pan because if I don't, all that powder will fall out. Then the weapon cannot be fired. Cast my musket about, pouring the rest of the powder and the musket ball down the barrel. If there were a ball in this today, I'd ram the paper down as wadding to hold everything in place, in that there is no ball at the moment. I'll offer it to you as a souvenir, sir. Well, black powder weapons foul, F-O-U-L. Kind of like when you eat sticky food. Even after the food's gone, you're still sticky. And the inside of this barrel will have that residue. A ball can get trapped in that. So each time I load, I take this rammer and make sure the ball is forced all the way down. If I fail to do that, imagine the ball got trapped here and the explosion took place down below. These barrels are rather thin, and if it got trapped badly enough, potentially it could blow up my barrel, injuring me or anyone close to me. So anytime I load the weapon, I would need to make use of this rammer. I've been asked several times, could you fire that rammer out like a really neat spear? Well, you could one time, but then your weapon's useless as anything more than a club until you replace that rammer. I'll step a bit further from you. I don't think it'll be real loud or scary, but if you'd like to cover your ears, it's not going to hurt my feelings. Give him fire! And that was the King's Arm on Brown Bess. It's a 75 caliber musket, which is pretty substantial by today's standards. The ball was a little bit smaller, typically anywhere from a 69 to a 71 caliber ball, because they needed to offset for the fouling we talked about earlier. It's a smoothbore. The inside of the barrel is like today's shotgun. They did have rifled weapons in the 18th century, but it was rare for the army to use them at this time, because if you think about it, a rifled weapon, the ball has to fit tightly with that rifle in that groove cut inside the barrel in order to spin your projectiles straight and true and fast. So with the fouling, that means that it's going to take you longer to load the weapon, and you're going to have to clean it after only a few shots. This allows for a faster firing, a faster reloading. And yes, we do know of a few specific campaigns where a handful of soldiers would be issued flintlock rifles, but that is not the norm during this age. To compare it to something we see today, oftentimes you will hear someone refer to a shotgun that is set up to fire slugs as the poor man's rifle. Well, in the 18th century, if you could only afford one weapon, the smoothbore was by far your best choice, because you could fire smaller shot in that, like today's birdshot. If you were hunting smaller game, you could have the big lead musket ball that's kind of like today's slug if you were after bigger game or an enemy. It is a more adaptable weapon than the rifled weapon was.
For further information, you guys have a website?
FortLoudon.com, and the spelling of Loudon is Loudon. I'm Will Kenton. I'm one of the park rangers here at Fort Loudon.
With the state of Tennessee?
Yes, sir.
Thanks, Will.
Thank you, sir. Pleasure being with you.
All right, and I'm Tom Wilmer, reporting from Tennessee. We'll see you here.
My name is Roseanne Cash. I listen to WNYC in New York. In fact, NPR is all I listen to. And if I didn't have NPR, I would feel like my lifeline to the world has been cut. So, yes, please support your local NPR station.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas Award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. Produced by California Central Coast NPR affiliate KCBX. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world. To learn more about Tom Wilmer's journeys around America and the world, log on to thomaswilmer.com. Funding for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by Hawaiian Legacy Reforestation Initiative.
Hawaiian Legacy Hardwoods and Four Seasons Resort invite you to sponsor a legacy tree and contribute to the biodiversity of Hawaii. Legacy trees can honor an individual, commemorate an event, or memorialize a loved one. Every tree dedication is a living legacy and a gift which grows grander year after year. The best time to plant a tree was 20 years ago. The second best time is now.